So I'm going to introduce the panelists and the commentator for our last panel and then let them take off. We've got three great papers and I'm sure brilliant comments, mostly because some of Lorian said some of it echoes what I said earlier, so I have great confidence that they're brilliant. Mike, so I'm going to introduce them in the order they're listed on your program. Michael Woods, who is, as of last year, an assistant professor of history at Marshall University in Huntington, West Virginia. He did his doctoral work at the University of South Carolina and has written a whole bunch of really exceptional things, including a great historiography of secession. Right? It was out in the JAH a year or two ago. And even more importantly, recently published Emotional and Sectional Conflict in the Antebellum United States. So it is, I don't know that he's still carrying it around. Leslie was talking about this yesterday, of sort of keeping a recent publication close to you, because it was in August, recently published by Cambridge Press. Let me get the titles, sorry. Michael's talk today is Mudsills versus Chivalry, Class Conflict and Total War in the Occupied South. Next up will be Michael Burns, who is a graduate student, a doctoral candidate at the university, at Texas Christian University. Michael has, like Katie, who will be presenting after him, extensive experience in the National Park Service, and has written, he's got a forthcoming article in the Virginia Magazine of History and Biography on the Confederate, called A Confederate Memorial, The Equal of Gettysburg, Sectionalism and Memory and the Establishment of Manassas National Battlefield Park. A place that he is well familiar with. And last up on our panelists is Katie Logothetis Thompson, who I'm proud to say is a former student of mine when I was at West Virginia University. Katie did her undergraduate work at Siena College and has, like Michael, as I was saying, extensive experience on battlefields in the Eastern Theater. And this is one of the real strengths for Civil War historians is people who know how to communicate effectively to a popular audience, and Katie does this very well. She's working on a really interesting dissertation, and a part of this we'll hear about today, The Invisible Toll, Mental Trauma, and Total War. I'm going to also introduce our commentator and then let them take over, and I'm just going to be the gatekeeper on time. The commentator is going to be Lorian Foote, who is currently a professor at Texas A&M University. She had been at University of Central Arkansas for a long time and has a whole series of great books. The first one, Seeking the One Great Remedy, Francis George Shaw, 19th Century Reform. And then a book that I suspect many of you know, The Gentleman and the Roughs, Manhood, Honor, and Violence in the Union Army, which was a finalist for the Lincoln Prize several years ago. And then a book almost done now on escapees, Union escapees, in the prisons in South Carolina and Georgia. I was dismayed to hear last night that Lorian doesn't work in the evenings or on weekends. I was like, wait, how is it possible that all these books come out and she just, it's like a 9-to-5 job, that the rest of us are working twice as hard and have half as many things. But Lorian's work has been great. This new book is really exciting and actually brings together a lot of the themes here that we've been hearing about. So let me welcome Michael up to the stage and we'll take it from there.
Thank you for that introduction. The usual thank you to the Filson. And the addition that I think this has become a real model of what an academic conference should be in terms of the diverse audience, in terms of the collegiality, intellectual rigor. I think it brings it all together. So I'm glad to have been here. I'm also glad to be going last, because I think it, no, I'm serious. Aside from the somewhat smaller audience, it's noticeably smaller, but thank you for all making it as big as it is. It gives us a chance, I think, to reflect a little bit more on how what we're doing fits with what has already been said, challenges, confirms, revises what has come before us. And so I want to cut against the grain a little bit, I think, with this paper, in looking at the men who carried out hard war, and I'd probably use that rather than total war from the title, just to avoid sort of some of the definitional disputes. The men who carried it out on the ground, we've heard some from policymakers, some from generals. I want to look at the men who are actually carrying out these acts of destruction and pillage and try to think about what they thought they were up to, what they thought they were doing in all of this. So it'll be sort of more on the practice end of hard war than the policy. Union veteran Eugene Ware began his history of the 1st Iowa Infantry by explaining what he called the miraculous speed and spontaneity with which Northern working men, his term, answered Lincoln's call to arms. In doing this, he underscored the battle between social classes embedded in the ostensibly sectional conflict that provoked Civil War. Union working men resented the arrogance of Southern planters. They loathed reactionary theories about the superiority of free labor or of slave labor societies. They sensed that their own liberty hinged on the defeat of what they considered an aristocratic rebellion. And for these reasons, Ware concluded, the Civil War was in fact, again his words, a great labor movement. Now when we talk about memory, I think this aspect of the war has really fallen off of the agenda. I think we know a lot about race. We know a lot about region. I don't think we know as much as we need to about social class and about work. Now, numerically, the Union Army was dominated by men who worked with their hands, but their influence went beyond numbers. So to understand the significance of their backgrounds, their class backgrounds, we have to place the war in a broader political context. Studies of the character and conduct of Civil War soldiers usually begin in April 1861. Amid the echoes of South Carolina artillery. But even raw recruits were veterans of political conflict that raged long before Fort Sumter fell. And as Ware suggested, insights from antebellum history should inform Civil War scholarship. Why men fought shaped how they fought. In particular, the ideological baggage that Northern soldiers carried into the conflict influenced the hard war that they unleashed on Confederate territory. The pillaging, the destruction associated with hard warfare represented more than a chapter in military history. It was laced with political purpose. Union soldiers regarded hard war as part of a wider campaign against an elite class long perceived as personally insulting and politically dangerous. To trace some of this political history, I'm going to focus on the pro-slavery mudsill doctrine, more on that to come, that clarified and intensified conflict between Northern working men and Southern elites. Building on pre-war precedents, Union volunteers refashioned the mudsill epithet that was hurled at them into a proudly subversive label, adopting this term for their own use, and memories of pre-war mudsill talk shaped their wartime experiences from enlistment and combat to encounters with enemy civilians, in ways that help explain why so many soldiers believed, and I would argue from the outset of the war, that hard warfare was essential to genuine victory. They fought not just for reunion, but also to protect their class by purging the nation of what they considered to be aristocratic taint. Victory demanded a realignment of political and economic power, and this required demolishing the foundations of Southern aristocracy. That, in turn, meant waging hard warfare on multiple fronts. So what am I talking about with mudsills? 3 years prior to Fort Sumter, South Carolina planter and Senator James H. Hammond threw down the gauntlet before Northern laborers in his so-called mudsill speech. Thereafter, mudsill doctrine was identified with Hammond's state and class. It became a kind of a signature of the slave power. Hammond was new to the Senate in 1858. He arrived amid the fierce clash over admitting Kansas to the Union under a pro-slavery constitution. But he didn't really care much about territorial sparring or about constitutional hair splitting. He believed the slave states had plenty of land. Now they must consolidate their power and savor their command of the world's cotton market. Hammond's March 4th address honed these ideas into a two-pronged rhetorical attack. First, he praised Dixie's economic and military strength, boasting that an imagined Southern Republic would dominate the industrialized world. Then he took the increasingly popular pro-slavery tenet that slavery provided the ideal relationship between labor and capital and cast it in especially offensive terms. Hammond proclaimed that every society needed an ignorant class to perform brute labor. Yankees erred by filling this class with resentful and enfranchised white men. But the South was blessed by racial slavery, in which inferior and politically powerless bondsmen did the dirty work. In a war between these societies, the South would prevail. These ideas were not new. They were not original to Hammond. But he articulated them in alarming language on a national stage. Most infamously, he declared, this is a long quotation, "In all social systems, there must be a class to do the menial duties to perform the drudgery of life. That is, a class requiring but a low order of intelligence and but little skill. It constitutes the very mudsill of society, and you might as well attempt to build a house in the air as to build either the one or the other, except on this mudsill. Fortunately for the South, she has found a race adapted to the purpose. We use them for our purpose, and we call them slaves. I will not characterize that class at the North by that term, but you have it. It is there. It is everywhere. It is eternal. The difference between us is that our slaves are hired for life and well compensated. Yours are hired by the day, not cared for, and scantily compensated." Ouch. From Boston to San Francisco, outraged Northerners erupted in predictable protest. The insult stung, and it stung especially because of its timing. The Panic of 1857 had shaken the Northern economy the previous fall, and thousands remained unemployed. Hammond had kicked the mudsills while they were down. He also legitimized pre-existing fears that slaveholders threatened the freedom of all workers, regardless of race or region. And by braiding pro-slavery theory with Southern nationalism, he primed Northerners to regard secession not merely as a bid for independence, but a plot against liberty. That is an important point. We'll return to that. Massachusetts Republican Henry Wilson later recalled that Hammond's open avowal of sentiments opened the eyes of Northern men to the spirit, aims, and purposes of the slave power, as perhaps no previous demonstration had been able to effect. The mudsill slur, in one very memorable, very quotable phrase, encapsulated everything about elite Southern politics that Northern working men feared and despised. Hammond's words immediately galvanized resistance. Before they fought against slaveholders, Northern workers battled them at the polls. Workers swiftly transformed his epithet into a humorously subversive badge of regional and class identity and a basis for political mobilization. In the summer of 1858, we see mechanics, laborers founding mudsill clubs all over the North. Members urged each other to beat the very life out of the sham democracy, Hammond's party, and vote Republican. Laborers linked working class pride to Republican success, quoting pro-slavery propaganda like Hammond's speech to inflame voters' hostility to the slave power. There's a banner hoisted at one of the Lincoln-Douglas debates that reads in part, "Mudsills of Society for A. Lincoln." 2 years later, A. Lincoln's national triumph propelled 11 slave states down the road to disunion. Memories of 1858 remained fresh in 1861, and they informed working men's views of secession. These aren't necessarily accurate, but it's important to know what they think is actually happening as the slave states leave the Union. Because Hammond's speech had fused Southern nationalism with pro-slavery politics, Northerners readily blamed the latter, pro-slavery ideology, for disunion. And the arrogant tone, the reactionary content, of Hammond's address seemed to explain secessionists' motives. One Northern recruit actually opened his wartime diary by exploring the connection. And I wish I could show this to you because every other word is misspelled, but yet his analysis is extremely sophisticated. "The slave oligarchy," he had trouble with that one, "of the Southern states, having lost their former political control of the government and not being minded to submit to the humiliation of sharing that control with the mudsills of the North," so here he's appropriating the term, "determined to secede from the Federal Union and form a confederacy of their own based on the foundation rock of slavery." He's writing this as he is enlisting. Other self-described mudsills itched to confront rebellious slaveholders in battle. Mudsill talk shaped enlistment and combat motivation. At least one impatient soldier wanted a chance to, quote, "teach the rebel scoundrels a lesson which will convince them that the mudsills of the North are fully equal to any chivalry the first families of Virginia can produce." Some volunteers even appropriated the epithet for their military units. Company G of the 10th Kansas called itself the Ogden Mudsills. Now we have armed mudsill clubs, and they're heading your direction if you're in the South. Not every Union soldier pondered mudsill doctrine and all of its intricacy, but its wartime uses reflected the lasting importance of antebellum politics. Union soldiers were a politically sophisticated lot, and recollections of this doctrine informed their understandings of what exactly was at stake in this war. After years of pre-war conflict with a hostile slaveholding class, many soldiers believed that secession was just another plot to bolster slaveholders' continental power. In a widely reprinted June 1861 article, the New York Tribune reported from among the recruitment camps that the phrase, "I am a mudsill," is now a common expression among the soldiers who fight for liberty. Recruits recalled Hammond's effort to, quote, degrade the laborer of the North to the level of the slave of the South. They understood, again, a quote, if the rebel states prevail in this contest, Northern workers will fall to a degrading position socially and politically. Now, this analysis may have misread secessionist goals, but it revealed the logic of working men's unionism, in which defense of class, of region, and of nation fused together. Union recruiters and opinion makers evoked mudsill talk to sustain enthusiasm for the war. They're very good at using this for their own purposes. When Edward H. Serrell sought recruits for an engineers and artisans regiment, he places an ad in a New York newspaper which warns that the so-called Southern chivalry meant to place the Northern mechanic on the same grade as the Southern slave, and reminded readers that slaveholders still called them Northern mudsills and greasy mechanics. By joining his regiment of combat engineers, skilled workers could weaponize their craftsmanship. Patriotic songs and poems also called mudsills to the colors. A song called Northmen Come Out appeared in May 1861, remained in print throughout the war, and I will not sing it to you. But one verse, which I will read to you, urged recruits to come out in your strength and let them know how working men to work can go. Out in your might and let them feel how mudsills strike when edged with steel. More sophisticated was the 1861 poem entitled March of the Mudsills. The poet began by celebrating Union soldiers' working class roots, imagining them as lumbermen from Maine and factory hands from New York and across the free states. The poet Gorham Stevens then defiantly recalled the taunting words of old when mudsills were derided and the gentlemen extolled. Stevens appropriated the label on behalf of the Union Army, saying that the taunting name of mudsills, we adopt it here today. After revisiting these now familiar themes, Stevens analyzed the balance of power between Northern workers and Southern aristocrats. National prosperity, he said, depended on working men, not among those who lived without labor, and war would expose Hammond's misreading of American political economy. Working class armies would sweep southward to vindicate the freedom and dignity of labor, and he actually hints already towards emancipation, against an aristocratic foe. They would rebuild the Union on a democratic basis, aligning political with economic power so that, and this is the closing couplet, the class that built the nation from their energy and skill shall be free to mold its progress by the edict of their will. So early in the war, we have Hammond's critics resolving not merely to restore the Union, right, not to rebuild the old Union of 1860, but to make a new Union that would be safe for working people by seizing power away from a dangerous aristocracy. So whether they're scribbling in diaries or publishing in newspapers, Northerners are interpreting this war as a collision between classes as well as sections. After tasting combat, Northern recruits ironically recalled mudsill talk as they relished their battlefield triumphs. And here, you'll figure out pretty quickly that I was thinking of this when I heard Joe's paper yesterday. Because a Union soldier who reports on an 1862 skirmish with Confederate cavalry, so we have the Union mudsill infantry against the flower of Southern aristocracy, the Confederate cavalry came dashing on in all the pride of the Southern chivalry. as they closed with a Massachusetts regiment, the Mudsills from Massachusetts, this is a quotation, unleashed a storm of whistling, stinging, humming mini-balls. Saddles are emptied, and the noble sons of the sunny South bite the dust. These men will not be drawing self-portraits after the war. The mingling of regional and social identities obscured where the sectional struggle ended and the class struggle began. Union soldiers and their admirers also savored opportunities for Union men to actually put their artisanal skills to use in the field. So we have articles like What Mudsills Undertake, in which an effusive Pennsylvanian reported that Northern mechanics needed just 48 hours to rebuild a bridge destroyed by retreating Confederates, exulting that an army composed of such material will not long allow any obstacles the rebels may place in their way to impede their southward march. So Yankee ingenuity gives Mudsill armies a strategic edge. Most importantly, though, for us, the insulting idiom of Mudsill doctrine shaped interactions between Union soldiers and enemy citizens in ways that underscored for Union men the necessity of hard warfare. As they captured Confederate territory, Union soldiers collided with hostile noncombatants, many of whom hurled Mudsill, along with other epithets, at the occupiers. So now it's a face-to-face encounter. A Union private who tried to drink from a well on a Mississippi plantation provoked what he called a southern cyclone of a woman, who called him all the names in the southern vocabulary that had ever been applied by the chivalry of the South to northern men, from Mudsills to Lincoln hirelings. These confrontations validated Union soldiers' darkest suspicions about slaveholders' attitudes and ideology. Scholars have suggested that hard war was to some degree, not perfectly, but was to some degree calibrated and fell particularly heavily on planters and on South Carolina planters, heaviest of all. These patterns are consistent with soldiers' class-inflected war aims. Frequently refreshed memories of Mudsill doctrine shaped destructive strategies, and these encounters with defiant civilians confirmed that genuine victory required the demolition of the slaveholding class. So how does one do this? Some of the destruction was psychological. Politically astute Federals yearned to humiliate their foes, partly out of revenge, but I think there's something else going on here too. In 1863, a Pennsylvania colonel reported that his men despised politicians who called for compromise, and this is a key off here for state elections. The key to a lasting victory was to subdue the Southern spirit. We must whip the South into proper respect for us, he wrote. Now, this argument was unassailable if one blamed elite arrogance for the war. When Hammond boastfully anticipated Southern independence, he taught Northerners to associate secession with snobbery. And in response, Union soldiers attacked the psychological mainspring of secession. Sometimes this meant actually hastening slavery's demise. And I would point to emancipation really as the elephant in the room when we talk about hard war and this attack on property. The most valuable property that folks are going to lose is not the family silver hidden in the smokehouse. It's of quite another type. Sometimes humiliating civilian foes meant freeing slaves. An artillerist reported from Virginia's eastern shore that his comrades thwarted a local master who boarded their transport to recover runaway slaves. Seizing the planter, whom the New Yorker describes as a perfect specimen of a fine Virginia gentleman, too fine to look at a laboring man unless he was a black one, the men tossed him overboard into Chesapeake Bay. The exhilarated Yankee asked his parents to imagine the scene, right? The aristocrat, quote, being tossed 15 feet in the air three times by Northern soldiers, by Northern Mudsills. His comrades simultaneously vindicated Northern labor and emancipated Southern slaves. They're fighting here on a psychological and an economic front. This master who ends up swimming to shore loses dignity and property in the very same moment. This inclination toward hard warfare appeared early in the conflict, long before the notorious 1864 campaigns, and it originated in the ranks among men who most keenly felt the sting of Hammond's remarks back in 1858. Scholars who argue for a grassroots impetus for the war often point to soldier psychology, to veteran status or to the proverbial unruliness of volunteer armies. But I would suggest that this important argument can be strengthened by attention to what's happening with social class and politics. Northern soldiers itched to unleash hard warfare against aristocratic enemies, and to conciliate the self-proclaimed chivalry seemed counterproductive and deferential. Writing from near Memphis, John Chaney, this is in 1862, John Chaney complained of having to be too gentlemanly. Now, Chaney was an entrepreneur. He was not a laborer. But he identified with working class soldiers around him. He and his comrades instinctively sought to demolish the Cotton Kingdom, and they had actually begun to do so on their own account, doing considerable damage in the way of cotton burning, as he put it. Officers quickly stepped in to stop them, and this, Chaney believed, made them look weak. Specifically, it made us look like cowardly mudsills who were here courting Southern favor. This is no way to win a war. He yearned for a more aggressive approach. He wants to subsist on the property of traitors, suggesting again a kind of a political calibration of hard war that actually aligns quite closely with Lieber, and to hang every guerrilla we could find to the nearest tree. Now, for his part, Chaney operates on another hard war kind of front, again, completely unauthorized. He does so through unauthorized emancipation. "I have helped hide away a smart mulatto slave tonight," he confided to his wife. "And by God, I will try to find some way to get him north." Determined to strike hard at the Achilles heel of a slaveholding republic, Chaney became a liberator. Now, of course, all of this psychological warfare, all of this emancipation, were accompanied by physical devastation. This multi-pronged strategy was calculated to obliterate the mental and the material foundations of the Southern oligarchy. Yankees especially delighted in the destruction of cotton, so when they're not stealing it, they like to burn it. Hammond's mudsill speech, after all, was also his King Cotton speech, and to destroy a cotton bale, or a cotton gin, or a cotton press, was to sap the foundation of the Confederacy. We have maligned free workers now demolishing the material basis of the slave power. An Ohio soldier reflected in considerable depth on this point in a letter to a hometown newspaper written from Alabama in late 1863. And I'm going to read you an extended quotation from it, because he paints a very vivid scene. "Here one sees the aristocratic Southern planter with his large plantation stocked with Negroes, counted by hundreds, and fabulous wealth. Cotton was then king, and his subjects lived and reigned in the highest style. This was in times before they undertook it to go it alone. King Cotton has now been dethroned, his subjects humbled. The mudsills of the North roam at will over the plantations, burning rails, foraging on the country, and the Negroes flock into our camps, leaving their lordly masters helpless and dependent. Sneering and turning up noses at Yankees is played out, and charity is acceptable. They vie with the mudsills in barter and traffic and get anything from a chicken to a horse. Cotton is whipped, corn is king, triumphant. Alas for the pride and boasting of the chivalrous subjects of King Cotton. Where pride is once humbled, there is hope of repentance." I think this passage encapsulated a lot of what I'm talking about, revealing how this mudsill doctrine, this class tension, shape soldiers' understandings of why the war came and how it could be won. The author begins with a caricature of elite Southern life, but it's one that's now been validated by firsthand experience. His description of aristocratic grandeur dramatized the contrast between antebellum prosperity and wartime ruin, in which he has had a hand in creating. He savored planters' self-destruction, connecting their desire to go it alone through secession with the ruinous consequences. As mudsills roamed at will across cotton plantations, they shattered the wealth, the pretension of aristocratic enemies. And in response, he finds that these rebellious planters no longer are quite so insulting. Instead, they now act more like Yankees, watching the bottom line in order to survive. He senses that the national balance of power has shifted northward. Corn is king now. And the future looked bright. And in fact, the Ohioan anticipates reconciliation through the repentance that he believed would accompany defeat. Humiliation, destruction, and deprivation would topple the pillars of aristocracy, bringing lasting and legitimate peace, at least as he is imagining it. This is the only way to defeat this rebellious elite class. So defiantly proud mudsills who burned and emancipated their way across the Cotton Kingdom strove to finish a fight that began years before the Civil War. Sectionalism mattered, as was evident in the Yankee epithet often coupled with mudsill, right? Not just any mudsill, but a Yankee mudsill. But workingmen turned soldiers knew that there was more going on than just a confrontation between a monolithic North and South. Their urge to vindicate both class and section prompted them to wage hard warfare on multiple fronts. Theirs, I would suggest, was only a partial victory. The continued use of the mudsill epithet during and after 1865 alarmed many northern onlookers. There's travel accounts where people are astounded that this term is still being used. And it starts to be cited as evidence that the spirit of secession still lingered. Some Northerners, including some former Democrats, actually respond to this by embracing the radical Republican vision for Reconstruction, thinking we haven't quite whipped the elitism out of these folks yet. Nevertheless, Union veterans long remembered the sweetness of their victory, and they will continue to cite mudsill doctrine in veterans' reunions and memoirs long after the guns fell silent. As one veteran put it in 1888, the Civil War had, quote, decreed that capital shall not own labor, that the mudsill, mechanic, and operator, as free men, are the bedrock of the best civilization. Rightly remembered as a watershed in a struggle for racial justice, the Civil War, according to the men who wore the blue, was also a milestone for working people of all colors. Thank you.
Thank you, everyone, for coming out this afternoon. Before I get started, I want to thank the Filson Historical Society for having us out for this conference, and especially Dr. Crothers, Dr. Weitz, and Dr. Sheehan-Dean for deciding that it was a good idea to have not just one but two grad students come out and talk about Indians at a Civil War conference. So really appreciate that. Throughout the 19th century, the U.S. Army played a central role in expanding the frontier for white Americans through conflicts with Native Americans. During the American Civil War, many historians may argue, the Army's role along the frontier became insignificant as they moved east to fight the rebelling Southerners. Yet, events in the summer and fall of 1862 explicitly linked the major fighting of the Civil War with the continued conflicts with the Plains Indians in the West. In the summer of 1862, Union forces in Virginia were desperate for victory after a number of setbacks. With failures in the Shenandoah Valley and outside of Richmond, the northern populace grew tired of rising casualties with little result and started to lose support for the Union war effort. In July of that year, these problems led Abraham Lincoln and Edwin Stanton to appoint General John Pope to command a new makeshift army in an attempt to jumpstart the war effort. Although Pope would fail to reverse these Union misfortunes, his civil military policies while commanding the Army of Virginia made a first step toward the hard war policies that eventually led to Union victory. While Pope focused on Lee's movements in Virginia, many Northerners heard the shocking news of the Sioux uprising that started along the Minnesota border on August 17, 1862. After his failure in Virginia, Pope was assigned to the Department of the Northwest and given the task of bringing peace to the Northern Plains. With his arrival, the Indian policy of the United States came under close scrutiny. As the head of the Department of the Northwest, Pope attempted to instill his own Indian policies that would reverse the corruption and deviousness of the established ones. When it came to civil military and military Indian policies, Pope implemented ones that contained similar hard war components in both Virginia and the Northwest. Although containing a number of major differences, one significant similarity emerged between them: deprivation. Pope believed that if he could deprive his enemies of key necessities, especially crops and livestock for food, he could bring the war, either with white Southerners or natives, to a close quickly. Both examples also show that although Pope initially supported extermination policies against the Sioux, the use of these hard war components relied on the actions of white Southerners or Native Americans. If the opposing population worked with the U.S. forces, then Pope would try to leave them be. If not, then they would receive the harsh terms set out by his policies. A comparison of Pope's general orders numbers 5, 6, 7, 11, and 13 as commander of the Army of Virginia and his proposed military Indian policies shows that the military policies of the Civil War carried over into the conflicts with Plains Indians while Pope commanded the Department of the Northwest. Such a comparative approach dealing with the U.S. Army during the Civil War era provides the opportunity to examine that institution, the conflict, and its leaders in three ways. First, it lets us place the Civil War into a larger context nationally by showing the relationship between the conflict east of the Mississippi and the wars with Native Americans along the frontier. Second, we can continue to question the extent to which the Civil War was truly a total war, as historians Mark Grimsley and Mark Neely Jr. have done. And finally, as Neely points out, Civil War historians have not fully examined the role race played in the conduct of warfare by the U.S. Army during that era. But Pope's military career provides the perfect opportunity to build upon these areas. After receiving his appointment to command the newly formed and demoralized Army of Virginia, Three Corps that Stonewall Jackson's forces had thoroughly beaten during his Shenandoah Valley campaign in 1862, Pope needed a way to both boost the soldiers' morale and to end the war quickly. For these purposes, Pope supported the idea of using hard war policies against Confederate civilians. By focusing on the harsher treatment of civilians through foraging and minor destruction, Pope hoped the war would end soon after. Following the lead of commanders in the Mississippi Valley, on July 18, 1862, Pope implemented General Orders Numbers 5, 6, 7, 11, and 13, introducing hard war policies to the Virginia Theater. In General Orders Numbers 5 and 6, Pope ordered, quote, "the troops of this command will subsist upon the country in which their operations are carried on." He added, quote, "no supply or baggage trains of any description will be used unless so stated specifically in the order for the movement." The army would rely almost exclusively on local food sources for both the men and horses. Pope's subsistence orders would both boost the army's supplies during the campaign and deprive local Confederates of food to feed themselves, their families, and possibly their army. The most contentious of his orders, however, were General Orders Numbers 7, 11, and 13. These orders provided a framework for dealing with guerrilla activity that could take place against the Army of Virginia. Pope declared that any person living in the region near his force was to be held responsible for any damage done to his logistical lines or for any attacks on his army. In response to damages to the roads and rail lines, Confederate civilians within 5 miles of the area would be coerced into repairing the damages and paying for the lost supplies. In addition, if any soldier or follower of the army was attacked during the march, quote, "from any house, the house shall be razed to the ground, and the inhabitants arrested. Any person known to have carried out the attacks, quote, shall be shot without awaiting civil process." Following along the same vein, in General Orders Number 11, Pope ordered his subordinate commanders to arrest all disloyal male citizens near the army unless they were willing to take an oath of allegiance. If one of these men then violated the oath, however, Pope ordered that the person, quote, shall be shot and his property seized and applied to the public use. General Orders Number 13 reversed George B. McClellan's practice of having Union soldiers guard the property of Confederate civilians. By living off the land and no longer protecting the enemy's property, it appeared that Pope had finally brought the war to white Virginians in a way that he hoped would end the fighting quickly. On the one hand, the enlisted men in Pope's ranks applauded these new orders, believing it freed them to commit fully to the war effort. One of the Virginia Army soldiers wrote home that the orders were, quote, "objectionable only insofar as they are not literally and completely enforced," end quote. Another soldier wrote that General Orders Number 11, quote, "gratified us exceedingly for a while," but General Orders Number 13, quote, "called out a hearty amen in all our corps." On the other hand, high-ranking Union officers and the Confederates despised these orders. Union Brigadier General Marcina Patrick called them, quote, "the orders of a demagogue." Another Union officer wrote, quote, "Pope's orders are the last unabatable nuisance. It means that the poor and the weak and the helpless are at the mercy of the strong, and God help them." Confederates practically named Pope a war criminal. One North Carolina woman wrote the orders were a, quote, "cruelty which no despot has yet surpassed," end quote. And Lee wrote he would, quote, "restrain as far as possible the atrocities which Pope threatened to perpetuate upon our defenseless citizens," end quote. Despite this perceived harshness, Pope used loyalty as a motivation for Confederate civilians to avoid damages or receive reparations. For General Orders Number 5, Pope included that civilians would receive a voucher for any provisions taken as long as they proved their loyalty since that date. In General Orders Number 7, Pope ordered that people could assure the security of their property and their safety by cooperating with the Union forces. General Orders Number 11 guaranteed that any person willing to take the oath of loyalty to the United States would be permitted to remain at their homes and pursue their, quote, accustomed avocations. For example, one colonel of the 82nd Ohio Infantry noted that some Virginians accepted these terms, writing that 71 civilians had taken the loyalty oath over about 2 days. And additionally, General Orders No. 18 laid out instructions for preventing soldiers from indiscriminately destroying property or attacking civilians. After receiving news of his orders abusing of his soldiers abusing the subsistence orders in General Orders No. 5, Pope reprimanded his army for what he considered their disgraceful actions. By having his men live off the land, Pope looked to motivate the Confederacy to end the war sooner by depriving Confederate civilians of the necessities for living. Pope's orders, however, also show the limits of hard war against white Southerners, since he tried to prevent indiscriminate destruction and killing by his men, a luxury Native Americans never received from most U.S. commanders during times of conflict. Unfortunately for Pope, civil military policies did not defeat Confederate armies on the battlefield. Although he had the opportunity to defeat a split Confederate force along the same fields where the Union lost the first Battle of Bull Run in 1861, Pope's mistakes during the fighting in the second battle resulted in another Union rout from the plains of Manassas. The defeat ended his career in the East, but not on the frontier. As Pope's men spilled their blood in Virginia, the Santee Sioux, after a group of young men killed five white settlers, assaulted a number of settlements and military posts on the Minnesota frontier as a preemptive measure against white retaliation and out of a growing resentment against the new settlers. Once relieved of his command in the East, Pope was sent to deal with this uprising as commander of the Department of the Northwest, which included the modern-day states of Wisconsin, Minnesota, both of the Dakotas, Iowa, and Nebraska. After Pope received his new appointment, Secretary of War Stanton ordered Pope to, quote, employ whatever force may be necessary to suppress the hostilities, making your requisitions upon the proper departments for whatever may be needed for that purpose, end quote. Immediately, Pope wrote to his subordinate, Colonel H.H. Sibley, ordering him to destroy crops and any Sioux property to deprive them of much-needed material for fighting the U.S. Army. More importantly, Pope, still seething about his defeat at Bull Run, first believed that extermination was the ultimate force necessary to end the hostilities. I think, Pope wrote to Sibley, as we have the men and means now, we had best put a final stop to Indian troubles by exterminating or ruining all the Indians engaged in the late outbreak. Although the idea of extermination existed in the conflicts against Indians since Europeans first settled in the Americas, the size of the frontier army during the Civil War, over six times the manpower that the regular army possessed prior to 1861, would theoretically make extermination on the plains a realistic possibility. But a year later, as his debacle at Bull Run faded from memory, and Pope became familiar with the situation in Minnesota in 1862, he revised his attitude toward policies against the Sioux. He saw the contemporary Indian policy as a complete failure for the U.S. government. It was, he believed, too expensive for the U.S. Army in cost of money and blood, and never truly solved the problems that led to conflicts between Native and white Americans. Similarly, Sioux leaders noted the current Indian policy as a key cause for the violence along the Minnesota border. So Pope examined the situation at hand as a military commander rather than an Indian agent by answering the question, how do you make peace? He proposed that the answer lied in the U.S. Army once again taking control of Indian policy as it had until 1849 when the Bureau of Indian Affairs joined the Department of the Interior. As historian Richard N. Ellis notes, to Pope's mind, two types of Native populations existed: semi-civilized, peaceful bands of Native Americans, and, quote, wild tribes, hostile natives which the U.S. Army would directly deal with. For the wild tribes, Pope believed the frontier army would fight them until they submitted. Then the government would create treaties that permanently ended issues with white settlement and unfair trade. If the government was not ready to create fair treaties with the Indians, however, Pope argued these bands should be left alone. Yet while at war with the Sioux, he believed in implementing military policies similar to his ones in Virginia. In 1863 and 1864, Pope renewed the campaigns against the Sioux in the hopes of bringing peace to the Northern Plains. His plans included striking at the heart of the Sioux homeland in the Dakotas to show the full power of the U.S. Army. To do so, however, Pope understood that the Sioux could not gain any supplies for fighting the U.S. Army and needed to weaken their efforts by depriving them of these necessities. During these campaigns, he planned on using a combination of direct conflict and deprivation of needs to push the Sioux into submission. Pope recognized that, quote, constant military activity during the summer months, along with the destruction of the Sioux's winter supplies, end quote, caused the hostile groups to surrender in increasing numbers after making the, quote, prospect of starvation a reality. Having requested the BIA to delay the disbursement of annuity payments, supplies, arms, and ammunition to the Sioux until after the campaign, he hoped to push them far beyond the Minnesota border and into the Montana Territory to prevent further contact with white settlers. After depriving the Sioux of their needs for the winter, Pope realized that the similarity in his policies from Virginia could prove effective in dealing with hostile Native Americans. Once these two campaigns came to a close, Pope believed he finally found the solution to the hostilities with the Sioux. By 1865, Pope solidified his military policy based on the success of the two previous years. After the Sioux agreed to surrender, Pope made treaties with the surrendering bands to keep the peace. The treaties I have directed, he wrote in 1865, are simply an explicit understanding with the Indians that so long as they keep the peace, the United States will keep it. If the Sioux continue to resist, however, Pope wrote, the military forces will attack them, march through their country, and as a natural consequence, their game will be driven off. After 2 years of depriving the Sioux of their needs, Pope saw this part of his policies as a possible way to end hostilities along the frontier. Once they surrendered, however, Pope believed the government should help the newly peaceful tribes. He argued that these bands should receive annuity payments, supplies, military assistance for protection against other hostile tribes, and fair trade with white settlers. Although his suggestions for policies in the aftermath of hostilities never fully developed, these show the carrot and stick motivations that Pope promoted through his policymaking. Similar to white Southerners, if the Sioux submitted to the federal authority, they would no longer be deprived of needs and actually receive some assistance. But if they continued to resist, they could expect to face even more indiscriminately destructive policies than the ones Pope implemented in Virginia, including the use of scorched earth policies. The employment of scorched earth shows the main difference between Pope's policies in Virginia and in the Northwest. Against white Southerners, he wrote orders limiting his men from and chastising them for abusing the subsistence orders and general orders numbers 5 and 6. Yet scorched earth policies on the plains, as Mark Neely notes, quote, had genuine possibilities even early in 1862, end quote, and terrifying effects against the Sioux. Quote, by 1864, Neely writes, quote, the army was indeed setting the prairies on fire, end quote. For example, during the campaign in 1864, Colonel Robert N. McLaren of the 2nd Minnesota Cavalry wrote that after he had attacked a Sioux encampment and driven off the people, he deployed troops to protect working parties who commenced destroying, quote, the vast quantities of goods left in the timber and ravines adjacent to the camp, end quote. This included buffalo meat, dried berries, buffalo robes, and riding saddles. Quote, finding that one day was too short a time to make the destruction complete, McLaren reported, I ordered the men to gather only the lodge poles in heaps and burn them, and then deployed the men and fired the woods in every direction. The destruction was thus complete, and everywhere was manifest the rapid flight of the Indians, end quote. When hearing reports of scorched earth against the Sioux, Pope neither condemned nor promoted this tactic. This could indicate that the men in the field decided for themselves when to use fire against Native Americans. Therefore, for the volunteer troops under Pope's command in the Northwest, the racial makeup of their enemy may have pushed them into inflicting indiscriminate destruction. But for Pope, believing in the effectiveness of depriving the enemy of their war-making resources, the ending of hostilities quickly and the reduction of casualties for U.S. soldiers most likely motivated his policymaking rather than racist ideology. Yet the employment of fire also as a weapon shows both the deprivation of Indian necessities by the U.S. Army and the indiscriminate destruction of Indian lands that never existed against white Southerners in the U.S. Civil War. By 1865, Pope had found a successful policy for the conflicts with Native Americans. Based on his ideas for hard war against Confederate civilians, the Department of the Northwest employed attacks against the Sioux that reduced their abilities to make war against the U.S. Army, including destroying food and supplies. Although the policies in Virginia did not end the fighting there, it taught Pope how to close out the hostilities with the Sioux when he did not have to worry about reducing the amount of violence used against his opposition. Despite this major difference, Pope's role during the Civil War and the Indian Wars between 1861 and 1865 shows that these conflicts have a direct connection which historians should no longer ignore. Thank you.
So I apologize for my runaway panelist moment a little while ago. As you can probably tell, I'm suffering from a pretty bad cold, and my body decided that that was a perfect time to have a very violent coughing fit, so I do apologize for that. And I have a couple disclaimers before we start. This is not a paper about guerrilla war, surprisingly enough, at this conference, but it does take our study of warfare in different directions. The idea of mental trauma as total war is not entirely my own. I read this concept. It was a very kind of quick side note in a book that I was reading, and for the life of me, I can't find my notes to tell me exactly which book it was, which is a shame on me. But a historian who was studying this topic in later wars made this kind of side note that mental trauma was total war on the soldier. So this is tangential to my research, my dissertation, which is on mental trauma in the Civil War, and since we've heard a lot about hard war, I do use the word total war, and I know there's different definitions of that, but I do use total war instead of hard war, which we've heard a lot about today. And I'm not a guerrilla historian, so if I say something wrong, don't turn vigilante on me, por favor. but from what I was reading, total war is usually described as a more unrestricted war, particularly in terms of the level of mobilization, the objectives of war, and the people involved. We've heard a lot about civilians and non-combatants and other modes of warfare that are involved in the Civil War during this very informative conference. I've learned a lot, certainly. This type of warfare, in terms of total war, is usually connected to the more modern age. The strategy is known for more intense combat. It's known for the involvement of civilians, as we've heard. Also known for a society's kind of total mobilization to support the war in terms of resources. So that's kind of going to get to my point in a little while. A society waging total war uses all of its resources in an effort to win the war and usually targets the resources of their enemy, which we do see elements of in the Civil War. And this is a conflict and a debate that's definitely happened among historians of the Civil War. We've heard the names Neely and Grimsley talked about a couple times already during this conference. There's the question of whether or not we saw total war in the Civil War that has led us to this term hard war, or as we were talking about yesterday, sharp war. That kind of distinction is something that I'm not going to really delve into. That's not the debate that I want to kind of comment on. But I'm going to use the concept of total war in a more abstract sense. This is definitely a think piece. This is very tangential to my dissertation, and it's definitely kind of a thought piece, at least for me, coming off of that idea of total war on the soldier. So central to this concept of total war, like I just said, is the full mobilization of resources and a more intense experience of warfare. And of course that means that that will have an effect on the people fighting it as well. So while the technologies and material goods of warfare change drastically over time, we can see that change as we go through different conflicts, the most basic resource of warfare has not changed. And that's the men and now women who fight these wars. So historians and psychologists who study these different conflicts and study combat stress reactions argue that the physical and psychiatric reactions to trauma that you feel in the body do not change over the course of history, even though our ideas and cultural concepts, our understandings of those things do change, the physical things that happen in response to stress do not change throughout history. So as historian Richard Gabriel states, quote, it is important to understand the historical record of combat breakdown for the simple reason that while the technology of war has changed considerably over the centuries, the raw material of war, the men who fight it, has changed little or not at all. Technically, technology will mean nothing if men cannot withstand the storm of battle, unquote. So men, the basic resource of war, have to withstand battle and the full experience of soldiering in a physical sense, an emotional sense, and of course a mental sense, which is what I'm studying. War is, of course, physical. We've heard a lot about violence and physical things that happen in warfare. But it's also psychological. It's a struggle psychologically in which men seek to maintain their own health, their own mental health, while weakening that of their enemy in order to convince them to retreat, maybe in a battle, or ultimately surrender. So another historian, Elmer Dinter, and I might say that last name wrong, he says, quote, "War means forcing one's own will on others by physical means. Its purpose, however, is not killing the enemy. He has to be made to believe that he is weaker and later that he is defeated in order to make him surrender. The dead and injured are only a means to this end. At its core, war is a battle of minds," unquote. And I love that quote, "War is a battle of minds." So as a battle of minds, warfare is constantly requiring the full mobilization of a soldier's own personal resources, thus reflecting elements of total war, this is where we get abstract, of course, within the singular unit of the soldier. When the body reacts to stress, it mobilizes all of its energy resources and shuts down the non-essential functions in order to focus on survival. So that's where you have accounts of people losing control of themselves, their bowels, shaking, things like that. Those are stress reactions where your body's shutting down all those other things to focus on survival. And then when that stressor ends, when the panic has gone away, the body is going to feel weak, hungry, tired. You hear accounts all the time of soldiers who, after battle, feel that kind of boom, that weight of what just happened, because your body's trying to rebalance all of its systems and bring everything back to normal. In a situation, however, when the stressor doesn't go away, so think extended combat, siege warfare, which we're definitely getting to, especially by the end of the war, the body's held at that heightened state for a longer period of time, meaning there's more exhaustion of those energy resources and the body can't rebalance itself because it just gets so depleted by the end of it. Now, trauma and stress and suicide, as I talk about a little bit today, but I did my master's thesis under Aaron on suicide, they're very tricky things. They're very individual things. It's hard to say for sure sometimes that a suicide, for example, is a combat stress-related incident. It's a very individual thing for every soldier. Every person reacts differently to these stress reactions. But with the same notion in mind, every soldier is at risk or can experience trauma, breakdown, or some sort of combat stress reaction. And reading psychologists and historians, they've used a variety of imagery to convey the limited nature of a person's resources, but more specifically a soldier's resources. One uses a bank account that they're constantly withdrawing from. One uses the imagery of the well of fortitude that will run dry at some point. And there are some others, as well. Historian Eric Dean Jr., who does a work comparing Civil War and Vietnam in terms of PTSD, reports that one lesson learned from World War II is that every man has his breaking point, that every man is at risk from some sort of environmental or combat stress. So during that war, psychiatric staff determined that American troops, after about 100 days of intermittent exposure to battle, that they would lose their effectiveness. And that total breakdown, could be expected after about 200 total days. Now, those totals obviously relate to that war. They might not be entirely accurate for the Civil War, but the underlying theory is there that after a period of battle, whether it's intense or intermittent, that there is the possibility that men would break down. And some break down more acutely than others, and some almost have no reaction at all. It's very individual, like I said before. So in kind of looking at the idea of total war in the Civil War on the soldier, we're going to look at the later years of war. If you think about hard war, a lot of times you think about Sherman's March to the Sea, or you think about some of these campaigns that are very, very intense and focus on civilians. We've been talking about this a lot over the last couple of days. So I'm going to look at 63 and 64. And some of the examples that I've pulled from my previous research on suicide, on the experience of prisoners, especially in the collapse of the prisoner exchange system later in the war, and also some research I just did about the government hospital for the insane in Washington, D.C. So for my master's thesis, as I mentioned, I did statistical and anecdotal evidence analysis of suicide cases. And there was 101 cases of suicide in the Union Army that I looked at. And of these cases, the largest numbers come in 1863 and 1864. And of course, there is the idea that the army is getting bigger as more and more people come in. But there's also these other issues that you see in 1861, you see in 1862, but by that middle and end period of the war is changing. The style of warfare is changing. And yes, again, talking about actual battlefields, not guerrilla warfare. So I'm a little of a black sheep in the conference here today. But you see the introduction of continuous campaigns. You don't see the spaced out battles of the early years. You see soldiers fighting continuously, doggedly, for weeks, months at a time into siege warfare, which we see definitely down at Petersburg. Campaigns that are longer means less time for soldiers to recap, to kind of relax and get their bodies back to normal. Soldiers are spending more time on the field with the dead, the carnage. They're not having enough time to rest, to recoup in any sort of way. There's a great example of how terrain also plays into this. And like Aaron mentioned, myself and two of my colleagues that were here today worked a lot at Fredericksburg and Spotsylvania National Military Park. So the wilderness is an example very close and dear to my heart. The wilderness is a terrifying place. And if anyone has visited there, it looks a little bit different now, but it's a terrifying place to fight, that thick, thick terrain. And there's a great account that I used in my thesis. A veteran, Frank Wilkson, recounts some scenes from the wilderness, and he says, especially of the threat of fire, because, of course, the wilderness is known for its terrifying fires that consume a lot of the dead and wounded, unfortunately. But he says, quote, "The bare prospect of fire running through the woods where they lay helpless unnerved the most courageous of men and made them call out loud for help." Then he continues on to say, "I saw many wounded soldiers in the wilderness who hung onto their rifles and whose intention was clearly stamped on their pallid faces. I saw one man, both of whose legs were broken, lying on the ground with his cocked rifle by his side and his ramrod in his hand and his eyes set to the front. I knew he meant to kill himself in case of fire, knew it as surely as I thought, as though I could read his thoughts," unquote. So the idea of suicide is not directly stated there, but it is. And he is commenting on the fact that even the most courageous men could be reduced to that state because of the threat of fire. And of course, the wilderness is a particularly terrifying example. And fires did indeed take the lives of a lot of wounded there. So this new mode of warfare and some of the terrains that they're dealing with in 1864 and, of course, 1863 too, it's grueling on the soldiers. It wears them down continuously. Where they could previously kind of recoup between battles, they didn't have that anymore. Historian Earl J. Hess writes about this, quote, "Continuous marching, digging, entrenchments, skirmishing, repelling or launching frontal assaults, hastily burying the dead, and then beginning the cycle of combat all over again was the rule for months." You can just imagine that continuous cycle going continually for months on end. And this led a lot of people to their breaking point. There's a great quote by Oliver Wendell Holmes Jr. of Grant's Virginia 1864 campaign. He says, quote, "Many a man has gone crazy since this campaign began from the terrible pressure on mind and body," unquote. So for men who had enlisted early on in the war, this stuff's coming after years of war in the field, losing friends and comrades, and of course, you know, their own experience of war. So I'm not going to go into a lot of my examples in depth. There's a couple in the paper that's up online. But I did find some suicides that were connected to these long periods of continuous warfare, especially in, there's one that I have in the 1863 Vicksburg campaign, where he is kind of constantly on the march or in fighting from December of 1862 all the way through, to the fall of Vicksburg in July of 1863. And then right after Vicksburg, this is where he commits suicide. He goes through that whole thing. He goes through the bio expeditions. He goes through the siege of Vicksburg, the fall of Vicksburg. And then that regiment finally gets put on guard duty for a wagon train. So it's finally that opportunity for the men to rest and relax. And the commentary that I found was kind of hilarious because their major, and they make a snide comment about the major looking for personal glory, gets them back on the front line the very next day. So they had one day on guard duty that they could finally start to relax and then put back on the front line, and then pushed forward before the front line into that kind of picket line area, and somewhere on July 11th, 1863, this corporal committed suicide. Now, obviously, again, individual reactions to battle, I can't 100% say that he was committing suicide because of this experience, but you can see how that long history of continual fighting could maybe have been a reason. And there are some other examples that you can read in the paper online in the lieu of time. So you have suicide, especially high rates in 1863 and 1864 that match up with some of these continual campaigns. You also see stuff happening away from the battlefield that increases the traumatic nature of the later years of the war. And I'm talking about the experiences of prisoners of war. Their experience will change at this point in the war. Early on, prisoners are kept for a relatively short time before being paroled or exchanged. And there's an agreement between the two sides that is formalized in July of 1862 to kind of outline how you properly deal with these prisoners and exchange them. But in 1863 and beyond, when we start seeing African-American soldiers in the ranks, some of that will kind of fall apart. There's disputes about how to deal with those prisoners, and the whole deal just falls apart. And that is where you get the situations like Elmira, New York, and Andersonville, which is, of course, those are the two most famous instances. And the camps get very crowded. They're very low resources. They don't have a lot there. And so inadequate shelter, inadequate clothing, food, very little stimulation. And, of course, with Andersonville, there's a lot of accusations of brutality and things like that. So if you manage to survive the experience of combat and soldiering, the foundations that you had to survive that would fall apart in a situation like this at a prisoner camp. And even down to breaking the bonds of camaraderie that was very important to keeping these soldiers going in the field and in camp life. Deprivation, monotony, disease, cruelty, and death forced a lot of these prisoners to kind of sink down into apathy. And a lot of people will note that prisoners who survive face longstanding psychological and physical, of course, issues after. And another great quote, and this is a person who didn't commit suicide, but Francis Walker was a prisoner. He wrote of that time that he suffered, quote, a period of nervous horror such as I had never been, never before and have never since experienced, and memories of which has always made it perfectly clear to me how one can be driven on, unwilling and vainly resisting to suicide. I remember watching the bars at my window and wondering whether I should hang myself from them, unquote. So just like the quote in The Wilderness, you see how this kind of stems from the experiences here. Now, Walker, like I said, resisted that temptation, but others didn't. There's an account of a cavalryman who tries to cut his throat with a dull knife. Another man uses his suspenders for a noose. So not a lot of resources in these prisons, but they're being very resourceful in some way, trying to kind of end this situation that they're in. The deadline is a very popular way of committing suicide, and that's the perimeter set up at these camps, where if you cross the deadline, essentially the guards can shoot you because you're, like, trying to escape. When you didn't have any other resources to use, some prisoners used the deadline as kind of a death by cop kind of situation. And it's interesting because there's always the idea that maybe they mistakenly stumbled across that line or didn't do it on purpose and it wasn't a real suicide. But in a lot of cases, it's pretty clear what they wanted. There's one where one soldier steps across the line and the guard shoots at him after he challenges the sentry to shoot him, and misses. And maybe it was an accidental miss, maybe it was a purpose miss. He finally, after two failed shots, the prisoner yells at the guy, "Do your duty," and the third shot hits him in the head, square, killing him right away. So for at least some of these soldiers, that situation has brought them down enough that this is the way that they're going to go, that they're going to commit suicide. Obviously a very cheery topic to end our conference with today. For those soldiers who did break down in the Union Army, and this is where my thesis, this is where I'm moving from my suicide thesis into my PhD dissertation, treatment is not easily accessible for these guys. Even though psychiatry is a growing field, there's growing understandings of insanity and mental illness. A lot of the Civil War personnel will, not have a lot of knowledge about mental trauma or how to treat them, and will treat most soldiers as malingerers, as cowards, trying to get away or being not masculine, things like that. So in order to reduce the chances that homesickness or mental illness or something would be kind of an easy out for soldiers, there are very specific regulations put in place to deal with soldiers who go insane during the war. So they're not allowed to be discharged. And they make it very, very clear that even though the policy of discharging soldiers is already very, very tight, no insane soldier is allowed to be discharged on a disability certificate, which I think is very, very interesting. Instead, they're supposed to be sent to the government hospital for the insane in Washington, D.C. So those soldiers who didn't do the extreme thing of committing suicide, which we talked about just now, maybe reacted in another way. Some of them made it properly to the GHI. Some did not get any treatment at all, which is something that I'm looking at in my bigger project. State and local governments ran most of the insane asylums and mental hospitals in the country, but the government hospital of the insane is the first and only federally funded asylum for specifically members of the military. So you can see a little bit of a forward movement with this. In the time that we have the Civil War, you're going to have, 460 men from the Union Army, of course, mostly Union, from June of 1860 to June of 1862, so the first couple of years of the war. From June of 1862 to June of 1865, we see 993 patients admitted from the Union Army. And if you look at the breakdown of the year, the last couple of years, especially 63 and 64, the numbers skyrocket. The numbers really shoot up in terms of men who are coming in from the Union Army being admitted into this government insane asylum for members of the military. Now, what's very interesting is we can see kind of maybe a connection between the rise of the numbers and the type of warfare that they're experiencing, but the superintendent will never make that connection. Throughout the war, he constantly will say it's not due to the war, it's because these men were already morally weak, or they already had things going on. And so even men that it's almost obvious that something in their combat experience has triggered this, the superintendent is very loath to kind of connect the war experience to these increased numbers. But it's possible, and like I said, this is kind of an abstract piece, but it's possible that the later years of the war in the style of fighting created more suicide, psychiatric casualties, or kind of traumatic experiences on a less crazy level than what we're talking about here. So while these examples are kind of brief, they suggest that the period known for the most intense style of warfare may have also seen a higher trauma rate, a higher casualty rate or suicide rate among Union soldiers. And soldiers throughout the war had to manage these wartime experiences throughout the entire war. But the changing nature of warfare in this second half of the Civil War, which we've kind of seen in the idea of hard war through most of our panels today, maybe accelerated that, maybe accelerated the breakdown, the stress reaction. And with soldiers in this heightened state of reaction and awareness during continuous campaigns, siege warfare, the worsening prisoner camps that we talked about just before, the mental experience of soldiering was in essence total war on the soldier because it required mobilization of all of that physical, emotional, mental resource in order to manage that experience and also to survive. So, thank you.
Well, thank you, and I am the grand finale for this conference, and I'm just so grateful to be here because I've really learned a lot from all of the panelists and have really enjoyed the conversations that are going on. I just want to begin by saying that I wrote my comments last week, and when Aaron was giving his keynote talk earlier this morning, I thought, wow, because I make some similar points that he made, so I want you to please don't think of me as a copycat. but that great minds think alike, because I didn't scribble all this down while he was talking. But my comments on these thought-provoking essays are really based on the title of this panel, which is Justifying and Surviving Violence. Because the use of violence is at the heart of war, but it's also true that a society's culture shapes the types of violence that are employed during war, decisions about who should be the target of violence, and the manner in which people understand the violence that is inflicted on them. Wayne Lee, who is a historian of war and society in the Anglo-American world, has argued that, and I'm quoting him here, war is defined by both violence and restraint. War is violence, but it is violence perpetrated by humans with the intent to communicate with other humans. War is intended to communicate a specific message to an enemy. Only rarely in history has that message been merely die. Historians of the American Civil War have grappled with the question of what promotes and what restrains violence during the war. What messages are communicated by violence? And how does Northern and Southern culture shape the way that war is practiced and experienced? So in this conference on the hard hand of war, I would like to put the three papers that we heard today within that scholarly conversation on violence and restraint and what messages were communicated. So one answer to the question of what restrained violence during the American Civil War was a common cultural belief in civilization as the highest form of human society. And we need to understand that the Americans who embraced this idea of civilization, they believe that what is important is that humans draw an absolute distinction between humanity and animals. It's very important to them that there's this fundamental distinction. And this understanding that people who lived in civilized societies knew how to control their animal passions and limit violence to its necessities. In contrast, did barbarians and savages who acted on animal instincts of anger and passion and unleashed indiscriminate and uncontrolled violence. And I mean, I think that's why it's important that when Unions and Confederates accuse each other of being barbarians, a lot of times that's in the context of saying the violence they unleashed was out of anger and there was no control and it was animal-like. So thus the United States and the Confederate States, when fighting the organized forces of the enemy, notice I said the organized forces of the enemy, tried to lay claim to a place among civilized nations by restraining violence through the customs and laws of war. And I had some examples, but I'm going to skip them because Aaron talked about some of them. On the other hand, historians have sought to identify factors that promote and escalate violence during the conflict, and factors that explain who becomes the targets of violence. Three out of many are I'm going to mention here. There's lots of factors that can promote and escalate violence, but I'm going to mention three. First, Wayne Lee suggests that in Anglo-American warfare, combatants practice restraint when they can envision being reconciled to the enemy and incorporating the enemy into their society. Otherwise, restraints on violence are loosened, as in the case of the English wars against the Irish and in the American wars against the Indians in both the colonial period and the Civil War. Because Confederates, for example, could not envision blacks being incorporated into their society, we see Confederate troops committing massacres and atrocities against the U.S. colored troops. I think that Michael Burns' paper contributes to this aspect of the conversation about restraint and escalation during the Civil War. Although he acknowledges a major difference between U.S. Army violence towards Indians and Confederates, the use of scorched earth and indiscriminate destruction against Indians, he argues that there was a significant similarity, the use of deprivation as a policy to end hostilities more quickly. Burns proposes to link the military policies used against Confederates with the military policies used in conflicts with the Plains Indians, an important and necessary task. But perhaps we also need to link the policies used against Confederates with policies drawn from Indian warfare in the colonial and antebellum period. Because what strikes me about the policy of deprivation that you describe was that that was a policy that was always used against Indians. When he was describing what Pope was doing in the Shenandoah Valley and what he was doing, I mean, I was thinking the first Tidewater War in, 1620. When we consider restraint and escalation, In the simultaneous Civil War and Plains Indians Wars, another factor that needs to be considered is the heritage of policy and strategy drawn from the conflicts that shaped both combatants' pasts. Another factor in the discussion about violence and restraint among historians is the fact that military officials escalated violence against irregulars, both men and women, during the Civil War in a way that they did not with combatants in uniform. Neither side recognized guerrillas on the other side as legitimate combatants. They recognized them as combatants, but not as legitimate combatants. They called them brigands, pirates, and murderers. And they believed their tactics were more akin to barbaric than civilized nations. And because barbarians refused to abide by the laws of war, they could be treated outside of those laws, and restraint does not apply. So the hardest of Pope's general orders that Michael talked to us about shootings and burnings, actually specifically applied to irregulars. Perhaps what we are really comparing is Union treatment of Confederate guerrillas with Union treatment of Plains Indians, since Union armies used violence against guerrillas and against regular combatants in the Civil War differently. Fourth, historians have used class as an analytical tool for understanding what promotes and restrains violence. In my own work, I argue that there's a common understanding of manhood that promoted violence in the Union Army, because there were men who believed that what defined your manhood was the ability to inflict pain on others and the ability to take pain and show that you could take it. And I described how in the Union Army they have to crack down on this class of men called the roughs who engage in huge, violent fights as part of their pastime in the camps, where they would just fight each other and beat each other. And so, ironically, the Union Army increased its use of violence to control violence that they perceived. But social class was a part of how they were perceiving violence. And I think that in his paper today, Michael Woods demonstrates that class shaped which Southerners became the targets of violence, right? Because part of what he's arguing in that paper is that perceptions of this arrogant elite social class shaped who the mudsills wanted to target, whose cotton they wanted to seize. He paints a vivid picture of Union working men unleashing violence against the Southern aristocracy they sought to demolish. Here, indeed, we see violence being used to communicate a specific message to a specific audience. Just as there are factors that promote and restrain violence during war, there are factors that work for and against combatants' ability to survive violence and the hardships of war. Historians have considered questions about what are resources that help an individual to survive the violence and hardship of war, and what are factors that break down the individual mentally and physically. On one hand, scholars such as Francis Clark, Mark Shantz, and Earl Hess have pointed to the power of culture and values to shape a participant's experience of violence. Collectively, these historians argue that violence and suffering was experienced differently by Civil War Americans than by later generations because of the cluster of assumptions that formed their mental worldview. They were deeply immersed in a culture that embraced pain and suffering as ennobling and as necessary, and that portrayed death as the beginning of life in a tangible and real heaven. This culture, they argue, thus mitigated the trauma of violence and even the potential of the war's violence to unleash the type of cynicism and disillusionment that we see after World War I. Catherine Shively Meyer, in her study of health and the environment during the Peninsula Campaign, has shown that soldiers who practiced habits of physical and mental self-care drawn from popular understandings of sickness and nostalgia, were better able to survive the experience of war. And scholars who study Civil War soldiers have pointed out that ties to family and community provided motivation and sustained soldiers to push through the hardships of war. But on the other hand, soldiers experienced factors that contributed to breakdowns in their capability to endure violence and hardship. Some scholars of Civil War soldiers argue that many soldiers became alienated from those on the home front because of their experiences that they could not really share or explain. I think Kathleen Thompson's paper identifies extended combat as a factor that works against survival. She points to studies of human psychology that argue that physical and psychological reactions to combat are universal and stand outside of culture. And Thompson's study stands at the intersection of the two larger questions historians have asked about violence. She links the escalation of practices of violence to questions of how that violence was then perceived and experienced. And she is faced with a challenging but necessary task, because the topic of her paper is important, of facing head-on one of historians' biggest methodological problems. And I mean, you address this well in your paper. But if war is a battle of minds, how do we get at the mind? And Corporal Paff, I don't think you named him when you did the paper here, but Corporal Paff, the Vicksburg suicide, he's a case in point. Was he depressed during the war? I mean, was he depressed before the war? Did he have access to the personal resources identified by Meyer and by other scholars of Civil War soldiers? There are federal prisoners of war who spent time in prison camps that claim that the soldiers who starved to death versus them who lived, they practiced some self-care tactics that these other soldiers didn't. And some of the federal prisoners of war blame the federal prisoners themselves for why they die. So if we don't know the answers to some of these questions, how can we interpret people's actions? And I think you address this, but it's important for us as historians to face head-on these methodological problems when we're trying to understand what's inside people's actions. So through all of the conversations that I've touched on in these comments, we are better able to capture the complexity of violence in the Civil War. I'm somebody who's actually comfortable with the idea that two things can be true at the same time. We must be comfortable with the fact that violence during the war escalated, but also remained restrained in other ways. We must be comfortable with the fact that habits of self-care and a worldview that embraced suffering enabled some to overcome their experience of violence, while others succumbed to the psychological and physical effects of extended combat. And finally, we must recognize the fact that violence sent messages that we must decode in order to fully understand the practice of warfare during the Civil War. I will open it to questions for our panelists.